This quatrain 50 also has this marvelous editorial comment about free will. And Swamiji says a few things in there that are just really worth contemplating. He says, people tend to consider the definition of free will, as he puts it, to be able to act in an unpredictable manner, which is for the ego to be able to do anything it wants without reference to the world in which it lives. And he says, on that level, no, we have no free will at all, because everything is interconnected. It's not possible to separate one little drop out of the ocean and say this drop is completely free of the ocean and will act without being influenced by the ocean or act not in concert with the ocean. He says that we tend to ask this question of free will as it's the wrong question. He says the question of free will is whether we not have the freedom to choose those influences which will produce our greater happiness, or whether we are so bound by our habits that we continually choose those things that cause us misery. And that's the only freedom worth having. We can't really have the freedom to act outside of the interrelationship of ourselves to this universe. We can't step out of our own past or step out of our inevitable future. But within the moving train, what we have control over is which way we orient ourselves. Do we orient ourselves toward a constant awareness of God, or do we orient ourselves to drink ever more deeply of the poison potion of depending on this changing world for our happiness? Where does our happiness come from? This is the only freedom that we really have. You know, everyone in the world loses sooner or later everything that we want. I mean, some of you have already experienced death of loved ones, or loss of power or position, or just many different things that this world does for us. My mother died a couple of years ago, and she'd been sick for a really long time. My life was not that dependent upon hers. And yet still, I'm astonished by the poignancy sometimes when I reflect upon her life. And I just think, oh, what a pot of poison this world is. You know, even though we know philosophically that souls go on and that we meet for a while, then we go away, and that everybody just learns the lessons that they're going to learn, still we're so tender-hearted and we get caught in the movie. And free will is the capacity to remain in bliss. That's the only free will that we really need. We don't need the free will to act in any particular way. Well, the free will we have to cultivate is the free will to be attuned to the divine. And that's what we need to work on. And that's always available to us. That's what the beauty of all this teaching is that no one can ever take it away from you. You can be beaten and imprisoned and starved and neglected and alone, everything. But you're never alone if you realize that you're nothing anyway and that you're only one with God. I remember Nitai. I've shared this with you, but it's such a sweet story. There's been a lot of discussion at Ananda about, you know, what will we all do when we all get old at the same time? There's such a large group of people who are essentially the same age, and should we have retirement plans, and should we have this and that? And it's all a moot discussion because there's absolutely no money to put toward those things anyway. But nonetheless, every so often people talk about it, and people put token amounts there. And there was one discussion in which there was a sort of group of people who were demanding that Ananda make provisions for their future. And Nitai sort of cut through the discussion in a way that was very moving, which is, he said quite simply, he said, this is not an agreement between me and any organization. He said, even Ananda, devoted as I am to it, he said, I'm not serving in order that someone will take care of me. He said, this is an agreement between myself and God. He said, I've given my life to God, and God will take care of me in whatever way he chooses. And he said, if at the end of my life I find myself with nothing, and he said, and I die of cancer alone under a bridge, is how he put it, let's get dramatic about it. He said, I won't feel betrayed by Ananda or by God. He said, that's not why I'm doing it. Now, these are very challenging ideas to get into our minds. But it's important to realize, if we're really going to trust in the infinite, and if we're really going to believe in karma, and if we're really going to give ourselves wholeheartedly, we have to have at least some courage in the experiment. We have to live in an appropriate level and can't be presumptuous and out of ego try to live at a level of renunciation that we don't actually have the experience to sustain. There's a very subtle distinction here. But we should definitely at all times strive to be genuine in the highest level of renunciation that we can reach, whatever that might be. And we need to be pushing the edge of that at all times. Otherwise, what will happen? We will just die stuck where we are. A friend of mine who's a little older than I am was speaking to me recently about some disappointing experiences that the person was having, about certain people didn't seem to be responding appropriately, and the person was then feeling not appreciated. And of course, they're older than I am. That doesn't mean they have one foot in the grave, but they're closer to the grave in theory than I am. And my only response was, do you want to die with these attitudes? You know, you're relatively speaking close to the end of your life. Do you want to just start over in a new incarnation with all of this, oh, people don't treat me right stuff? It's just such a dreary, horrifying prospect. You know, be glad that you're having a sense of being mistreated now, because that tells you that you haven't overcome this yet. You know, we're never too old to be ignorant. It's very impressive. And so when these things come to us, ask yourself, bad enough I should be experiencing this now. Do I want to start all over and run a whole incarnation? Do I want to go through childhood and adolescence with these same lessons? You know, it's not easy, but let's put out the courage. The next one is really clear on that one. The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on. Nor all thy piety nor wit shall lure it back to cancel half a line, nor all thy tears wash out a word of it. I wrote here that we really have to think before we act, don't we? Because once the karma is set in place, doesn't matter how much we plead and cry, no matter how wise we get in our theology, no matter how pious we become, the energy set in motion. You know, is it easier to stop the wrong energy now, or is it easier to live through the consequences of it? Sometimes you have to ask yourself that question. When we're faced with temptation to be unkind, to be inattentive to our spiritual practices, to have wrong attitudes, to do hurtful things to others, just ask yourself, do I want to experience the consequences of this? Is the pleasure of at this time going to be worth it for all that's going to come back to me later? The moving finger writes, and once it's writ, you can't undo it again. How many of us have sat and thought, oh, if only. I remember Richard Sabina Wormbrand. Richard Wormbrand is a great Christian saint. I think he's still alive. He was imprisoned for many years by the communists in Romania for being a Christian. His wife was also imprisoned. And in the women's prison, she found herself, some of her companions in jail were society women. You know, wealthy women who'd only lived lives of superficial pleasure. She said, really, they were so much more unhappy than anyone else because they had just nothing in their heads. And she said also, alone, I think it was he or she said that hell is sitting alone in the dark with all your regrets. It's a very interesting way to think about it, isn't it? With all the things you wished you had done differently, the moving finger writes. And no matter how much we plead and cry, it's still there. We've set it in motion. And so we should just remember, just before I act, do I really want to live through the consequences of this? And sometimes it can be very sobering and keep us on the straight and narrow. It's all just a game. All of these verses are written to inspire us to right action. And right action is Dharma, and Dharma is that which expands our consciousness and brings us to self-realization. A magic shadow show, the moving finger writes. These are things worth remembering, aren't they? Because there's a power in those phrases that goes deep into our consciousness. The less ego we have in everything we do, however, the less karma we have. Master writes that a specific karma can be canceled only in two ways, by an equivalent opposite force or by the elimination of ego as the magnetic center. And that's how ultimately you see we overcome all our karma. It's not that you actually live everything out. It's that what attracts the karma to you is the magnetism of the ego that says, I did it, this is me. If you dissolve that sense of I, then when the energy returns, there's no I to attract it to you. Do you understand? That's how Kriya works. That's how the grace of God works. That's how going into self-realization gets us out of this. So the more we concentrate in a general sense on eliminating our sense of identity, personal identity with the life we're living, and the more we just identify ourselves as an expression of the infinite moving with His power through life, that the more our consciousness moves there, the more we dissolve that power of ego that attracts that karma to us. That's why it says elsewhere in here that karma that's in motion for a devotee often strikes with much less force than it was launched. As he said, like if you were destined to lose an arm, you might just scratch your arm instead. Because there's the egoic force to draw that energy to a focus in you has been dissipated to such an extent that only some of it attaches. It's very interesting, isn't it? And that's what we do when we do kriyas, that we transfer our sense of self from the medulla where the ego is to the spiritual eye where Christ consciousness lives. And so we become not the ego anymore, but the divine in harmony with the infinite. And then that karma looks for the ego and it can't find it. And it dissipates into the divine. So that the devotee, the law of karma, doesn't apply in the same way to devotees. That's what Master said. After all this about karma that's in here, Master said the law of karma does not apply to devotees in the same way. Because they have the grace of the guru to protect them. They have the power of their spiritual practices to diminish the hold of the ego. And those two forces accelerate. That's how it works. That's why one kriya can be equivalent to 12 years of normal living, because you're dissolving the ego in the way that life experience would do. You're doing it more quickly, and so the karma is going away. Very promising, isn't it? I'll read one more and then we'll take a break. Number 52. And that inverted bowl we call the sky, where under crawling cooped we live and die. Lift not thy hands to it for help, for it rolls impotently on as thou or I. This is actually a direct reference to astrology. Omar Khayyam himself was an astrologer, and the science of astrology was a very big art at the time that he lived. It's very important to realize that the science of astrology and the science of yoga were both created in India at the same time. And the science of astrology, correctly practiced, really is a science. But what your horoscope is your horoscope is an external expression of the karma in your spine. And it's the karma in your spine that creates the horoscope. It's not the stars that create the karma. And so even though you can look to your horoscope to help you understand the subtle influences that are going on inside of you, the PowerPoint is not external but internal. And therefore, by spiritual practices, you can change the karma and therefore gain mastery over the stars. They do not have any inherent power to affect you. It's very important, even the little bit or the great deal that those of you or those of us who pay attention to astrological things, all it is reading the book of your inner self. It is not creating your inner self. And it's very inappropriate to allow the thought of your astrological condition to actually dominate the thought of what you yourself are going to be able to make happen. It merely describes for you the conditions that you're facing in order to make it happen, favorable, unfavorable, oriented this way or oriented that way. But it is not creating your destiny. You created the horoscope and you are always in charge. And that's why it says don't look to the stars for help. You can't pray to the stars to make it work for you. You can't appeal to them. They'll just tell you what's going on, and then you make of it what you will. You know, Master said in his own life, sometimes he would seek out times when the astrology was particularly unfavorable, and then he would just use his willpower to make things happen anyway. And sometimes it would take more willpower, but he did it to prove that he was always stronger than any external reality. And when his horoscope said that he would be married 3 times, he took the horoscope and he burned it to ashes. And 3 times they did try to marry him, and 3 times he absolutely refused to fall in with their plans, because it was merely the inclination of his horoscope. His destiny was in his own hands. And it's very important at all times to just reiterate that to yourself over and over and over again. Maybe the astrology can help explain you to yourself when you feel confused, but it does not create your reality. You create your horoscope. You create your reality. Nothing external does it. Okay, let's take a break. 10 minutes. Comment, Brenda?
You mentioned nirvana. And is that part of our belief system, or?
Do we believe in nirvana?
Yeah.
Swamiji has commented about it in several places. He's commented that the Buddhists talk a lot about nirvana as the annihilation of everything. Swami's written, I can't remember where it is, but he wrote about it at great length and mentioned that no wonder people decide to stay around and help the planet, because who would want it? And he says that it's not really what Buddha taught, because Buddha taught full self-realization, that nirvana is the stage before the state of bliss. I'm quoting, but this is how they describe it. When all experience, this whole world disappears, all sensory awareness disappears. That's a state, but that's not the end point. The point after that is bliss. Because that kind of annihilation in itself is a negative state. And that's why they talk about you have to reach there, but then you have to have the courage to go on from there into something else. Can anyone remember where Swami talks about that? The Book of Superconsciousness, that's where he talks about it. He talks a lot. He has a long discussion about nirvana and what the Buddha really taught, and what a confusing teaching it is to talk about nirvana as the end point. Of course, most of the people talking about it are not experiencing it, so it's really just words anyway, and experience takes over, no matter what you think. But even to have a clear concept of what you're trying to achieve helps. Because if you realize that bliss is the goal, not nothingness, bliss is a much more dynamic reality to attune yourself to than mere nothingness. You can see if you're attuning yourself to being nothing, you don't always know what to do, and it can make you very dry. It can also make you very unfeeling. And it can also make you very reluctant to go there. Whereas if you know that your goal is bliss, why would you hold back from it? But Swamiji actually talks about, I think in Superconsciousness, he talks about in that moment of nothingness, as he put it, there's a moment of intense loneliness when you realize that you are the only thing that is. But then you realize the bliss on the other side of it. It's very poignant the way he wrote it. Yeah, Rick, did you want
to... Well, just the idea of the bodhisattva.
Is the one...
Compassion is that everyone else will be saved before they are.
Right, Swami jokes about that. It's no wonder you choose to be a bodhisattva, because it's not that attractive to just go into nothing. But he's teasing when he says that. Any other comments? Was there someone over here? Yeah, but I know, the first time nirvana appeared in our literature, so to speak, I was surprised too, because it seemed like it was a crossing of wires. Not that, of course, it is. I mean, how narrow-minded and silly can you be? But it isn't what we talk about normally, but it does come up in here in several places, because Omar Khayyam talks a lot about nothing. And that's, I guess that's the right word for that state of nothing. Okay. Now we're reading number 53. With earth's first clay, they did the last man's need, and then of the last harvest sowed the seed. Yea, the first morning of creation wrote, what the last dawn of reckoning shall read. Isn't that beautiful poetry? It's a little bit hard to sort of grasp. The last harvest sowed the seed. This is, again, still about karma. And that as soon as we were created, desires were also planted within us. And as they say in several places, karma is self-replicating. And this is this line, and then the last harvest sowed the seed. All the seeds, all that happened in the last life becomes the seeds of the next life. This is a reference to reincarnation and the laws of karma. This is just what I was saying earlier. You want to die with this attitude? You die with this sense, all these unlearned lessons that we have refused to face and deal with in this incarnation. All that happens to us is we get to start over, except we don't necessarily remember why we feel that way, and we have to go through that whole process of learning how to eat, and how to find our mouth with a spoon, and walk, and talk, and all those other things, and just even to just get a grasp on what we're doing, and all that we do, finally, when we've got our body organized, is bingo, we're right where we stopped. Just exactly right where we stopped. Of the last harvest sows the seeds of the next life. That's why even, there's never a point in which it's too late, to apply our consciousness with great energy, because we always go on. That's why even Master says things that are very subtle to sort of grasp. He says, You know, even if you're dying, you should keep trying to get well. He said, keep, always affirm good health, even if you die trying. That's how he phrased it. I love that. And it's, and of course, you can't be, you can't just be foolish in that thought. I'm suddenly, John, we just killed the sound.